Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together, we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hooray! We're back! We're back! We're back! We're back! We're back live and in the studio, so to speak. Hi, I'm Peter Hart, and who are you?
I'm Gary Bain.
Oh, and we are live with our new podcast, and it's called Countdown to Disaster at ANZAC, 6th to 7th of August 1915. And it follows on from the series of reruns, doesn't it?
Does it? 6th to the 7th of August?
Yeah.
Oh, right, OK. Don't say 5th to the 6th of August.
Yeah, that's wrong.
Start as we mean to go on with an error.
Well, you should have realised the date.
You've had 6 weeks to get somebody else, and here I am again.
So here we are. Here we are again. So give us an idea of what this talk's going to be about. Set the scene for us, Gary, as only you can.
Okay, well, the British plans for the August offensive bore all the distinctive attributes of Hamilton and his staff. They were not stupid in the sense that considerable imagination had been shown and there had been a commendable attention to detail in their construction.
Yeah, that's all true. The detailed plans have got some... They're not stupid people, are they, these staff officers?
No, but the problem lay in the overcomplication that was indeed the very hallmark of a Hamilton plan and had been on the 25th of April.
Yeah, so just as on the 25th of April, you've got a rash of schemes. And I use the word rash carefully.
You could scratch that.
Yeah, well, they're just schemes from end to end of the peninsula, just like on the 25th of April. Just too many elements that are sort of supposedly dependent on each other's success, but all of them actually physically separate entities, and they're not able, are they, to help each other, whether they succeed or fail.
Yeah, I mean, once again, there were diversions that were in fact major operations in themselves. And then the forces assigned to the various operations were totally unsuited to the operations that lay before them.
Give us some examples of that then, Gary.
Well, for example, the ANZAC Corps, charged with the main responsibility for breaking out of ANZAC, was a husk racked by disease and suffering from an underlying exhaustion. The British units, which were to make the new landings at Suvla, were totally inexperienced.
Yeah, and then again, the 8th Corps at Helles, they're experienced enough, they are, but they're buggered as well, to use that fine technical term.
Or worn down might be another way of saying that.
Would be another way of saying it. They've been continually attacking Turkish lines between them and Achi Baba, which was only, by the way, the preliminary objective. How would you sum this up?
Well, they're seeking to create diversions by attacks that bitter experience showed were bound to fail in a welter of blood. And worst of all, it demanded, despite all the evidence so far accumulated, that the Turks would fight badly.
Had they fought badly before?
No.
They'd been brilliant. Yep. Now, today, this podcast is going to deal with the diversionary and preparatory operations planned at ANZAC. We've had another podcast, you can look in the past, that deals with the diversion at Helles. We've also dealt with the Suvla landings. But we've gone back and we thought we haven't done enough on ANZAC, so we're doing ANZAC this time. So which part What are we going to do?
Well, the assault by 1st Division on Lone Pine in the late afternoon of the 6th of August to deflect attention from the main assault columns, which were going to punch out to the north of Anzac.
That would be on the night of the 6th, 7th of August. So it's a daytime attack, but it's to deflect attention, yeah. What else are we covering in this podcast?
Well, as you mentioned, the attack to be launched at midnight on the 6th of August by the 6th Battalion from Steele's Post on German Officers' Trench to prepare for the assaults on Quinn's Post and the Neck. Now, all of these places are all accessible. We'll be going there in May and October this year.
Can't wait.
And you can see, for example, at Lone Pine, how close those trenches were.
Well, it's when you look at Lone Pine, and that's what, let's start with that. When you look at Lone Pine and you're there, it's a cemetery now, yeah. But you could see the size of it. It's a small football pitch, a very small. And actual fact, when they have the 25th, you haven't seen it on 25th of April, but they put grandstands up and it actually looks even more like a football pitch. That's about that. The whole area is sort of within that. Now, who's going to make the attack? Because it's not the whole of 1st Division, is it?
No, it's the Lone Pine operations are the 1st Brigade of the 1st Division, and it was very daunting.
Why?
Well, their attack would be on a front of just 140 yards wide, attacking across 80 to 130 yards of bare arse open ground to reach the Turkish trenches on Lone Pine.
Yeah, and the Turks, those trenches are not easy to take. The Turks have tried their best to make them impregnable. They'd cover the top with pine logs. Thank you. I'd lost that word completely. You spotted that.
I did spot that.
And which provides head cover. And they'd also, where possible, try to put out barbed wire. It's quite difficult in that sort of terrain when the trenches are pretty close to each other. Who's commanding 1st Australian Division at that time?
I think that's Major General Harold Walker. He was indeed commanding the 1st Australian Division, and he was worried. And he
I'm not surprised.
And he seems to have strained every sinew to improve the chances of his men by a series of measures designed to get them across the killing zone as quickly as possible. After all, the more successful they were, the more effective the diversion would be. Remember that word? Diversion.
Yeah, you'd think that'd be the case, but we'll be coming back to that point, that very point. Yes. We've talked about that on the site before, haven't we? So, what did he do? Well, firstly, they dug a series of shallow tuggles. I'm going to dig a tuggle. So these are just shallow tunnels, and they feel their way out into no man's land, trying to get to it, well, about 40, 50 yards from the Turks, and... Well, the idea is that you could break open the top and then burst out, and you'd have less ground to cover. And what would they be once you've broken the top off? What would they be?
Well, they'd then become ready-made communication trenches for reinforcements if the attack went well. Now, as a diversion, they were meant to draw attention to themselves. So, a bit like you. So, a leisurely three-day bombardment was opened up to gradually destroy the Turkish wire defences.
And then at 1400 on 6th of August, three mines will be detonated in no man's land. part of the idea of that is this is something they do a lot at Gallipoli. It's to try and create, when the earth goes up, it comes down and creates a crater and provides a bit more cover from the disturbed earth in no man's land. It doesn't always work. What were the men doing?
Well, there were some quite mundane preparations. In the last half hour, the bombardment would increase in weight, hopefully smashing holes in the covered trenches and forcing the Turks to take shelter in deep dugouts. And we've got a quote here from 2nd Lieutenant Charles Leckie of the 2nd New South Wales Battalion. I'm not going to do any stupid accents today.
No, not today.
White patches were sewn on the back of the men's tunics.
Hang on, are you saying Australian accents are stupid?
The way I do.
Yeah, all right. Back to it.
White patches were sewn on the back of the men's tunics and around the sleeves as distinguishing marks. Dry rations, ammunition, picks and shovels were carried by all ranks. Officers carried rifles, ammunition, packs, etc. And in addition, each platoon commander carried two artillery indication flags and a large percussion bomb. Lieutenant Craddock's last advice to me was to fix a certain sandbag in the enemy's parapet, make a beeline for it, and run my hardest when the whistle went.
Yeah, they're really keen to get across no man's land as quickly as possible. These aren't the green and sort of unsophisticated troops that had landed on 25th of April. And no, that's no disrespect to them on the 25th of April. But they were raw then. They've improved how they've become more tactically adept. They don't needlessly expose themselves to fire, hence get across no man's land as quickly as possible. But knowledge, it's a bit of a two-edged sword. And what do you think these men, these experienced troops, thought as they were looking across no man's land?
Well, they now knew the terrors that lay before them.
So they're not optimistic. They know if anything goes wrong, they're going to be shot to bits. So finally, the whistles blow, and three waves of men went over the top, running as fast as they could. And amongst them was the aforementioned 2nd Lieutenant Charles Leckie. He's 2nd New South Wales Battalion.
I followed the advice and ran for one of the black sandbags in the Turkish line. I cannot remember hearing a sound, although the Turkish machine guns and rifles must have been firing. Neither can I remember having seen anything except that sandbag until I crashed into a deep hole about halfway across. Captain Payne was in the hole, busily trying to plug a bullet hole in his arm. He requested me to help him out, as it was too deep for him to scramble out with an injured arm. I tried to get out, but toppled back under the weight of my equipment. Captain Payne pushed me up with his good arm, and I then pulled him out. Captain Payne, despite his wound, and I then raced on and reached the Turkish line. Many of the men, exposed to and suffering casualties from machine gun fire, were firing through the logs with which the front line was covered. I called to them to jump into a communication trench, which I saw and jumped in myself.
Yeah, you've got to realise, so there's the front line, there's communication lines going back to the second line, and he's got into a communication line. Now, over on the left, and I can picture this, over on the left is roughly where we park the bus and where we have our lunch. To the left.
Is that
of
a euphemism?
No, it's not a euphemism. It's where we have our lunch.
Oh, right, okay.
And Captain Ivan Mackay and the men of 4th Battalion, they had been told to vault over the front line because it was, you know, covered, go a further 50 yards back and then enter the support line trenches and then send parties back towards the front line. In other words, go past the front line and then back down the communication trenches.
And that's to mop up any of the remaining Turks.
Yeah, and to clear them out. And this is Major Ivan Mackay, 4th New South Wales Battalion. Our sudden attack took them by surprise, but nevertheless, I have a distinct recollection of little puffs of dust appearing at every loophole as we ran across no man's land. As A Company ran beyond the front line, we found the Turks running beneath us in the communication trenches whilst we ran along the top. We shot a number of these men, firing our rifles from our hips. Ooh.
Now they ran on and dropped into the next Turkish trench before turning back to clear out the Turks. One Lance Corporal Joseph Alwood was lucky enough to pick a relatively quiet spot. And this is Lance Corporal Joseph Alwood of the 4th New South Wales Battalion.
Where I landed in the support trench, no great opposition was met with. Picking up with two other members of the battalion, the three of us moved along the trench until we came to a cross trench leading to the front line. On the other side of a bend were a number of Turks, who, however, gave way as we charged round it, shouting as loud as possible. Reaching the front line, we were again temporarily held up. At this stage, Lieutenant Selden, with his eye shot away, came round from the support trench and ordered us to advance along the front line and clear out the enemy. Wow.
Now, Selden's eye was a macabre sight, the mangled remnants hanging down on his cheek. He nevertheless refused treatment and pushed on with his party down the support trench, which ran parallel. As ordered, Alwood charged along the front line, and you're going to tell us more from Lance Corporal Joseph Alwood.
We hunted around and found a few bombs, which we threw into the trench, shouting and cheering as we followed them up with rifle fire. The ruse succeeded. The Turks retreated across the communication trench into the jolly. We once demonstrated, if you remember, this famous film of you demonstrating bomb throwing and clearing trenches. On arrival at the point where the Lone Pine ended in the trench across Owen's Gully, we found Lieutenant Selden's body lying across the head of it. Peering round the edge of the trench, I saw a large body of Turks apparently waiting to repulse an attack down the communication trench. I therefore cut a niche in the side wall of this trench and engaged the Turks with fire, while the others proceeded to drag the sandbags from the top of the old front line in order to block the trench. The sun glistening on my bayonet soon gave our position away, and the Turks poured in a hot fire. By this time, the sandbags were ready to place in position, and when they had been built high enough, I crawled across to Lieutenant Selden, but found that he was quite dead. I therefore took possession of his revolver, and we buried his body in the sandbag barricade. There was no sign of any of his party. While we were thus engaged, numbers of the enemy had taken advantage of the absence of firing to crawl towards the barricade, but they were discovered in time and driven off by fire. The trench at this point was about 9 feet deep, but had no fire steps on the side facing the jolly. That's Johnson's jolly. Setting the others to cut fire steps, I proceeded along the front line to establish touch with the rest of the battalion. Wow.
Now, he'd done a splendid job in helping to secure the northern flank of the advance onto the Lone Pine position. And just before we go on, I'd like to say that actually, if you visit the Johnson Jolly Cemetery, you can find the memorial to Lieutenant Selden.
Yeah, it's a memorial grave. I mean, it's not where he's in the cemetery, but
he's in there somewhere, but it's not necessarily where that stone is.
And I always remember we was talking about this, and I was saying about, you know, how he lost his eye and carried on commanding his troops. And then I looked up, and there was a British officer, and I. facing me, and he'd also lost an eye. And I remember the story that had been told to me by our friends of how he'd been in Afghanistan when a rocket patrol grenade had hit his vehicle, taking his eye out. He'd got out of the vehicle, still leading his men and with his sergeant major beside him, and then he was hit through the thigh by a bullet. And at this point, he was still trying to lead his men. And the sergeant major told him to fuck off, sir. Which sort of sums up the courage of the officer, the pragmatic nature of the average NCO. But it also shows that things haven't changed. So just that brave officer, Lieutenant Selden, but things haven't changed. There's still brave officers today, brave men just today. And whenever I see Selden's grave, I remember that British officer, and I remember I remember Selden, of course.
Now, somewhere nearby was Private Charles Duke, and this is Private Charles Duke of the 4th New South Wales
battalion.
Same battalion. I was trying to get my breath when from the right end of the traverse, a big fellow of a Turk came bolting along the trench. He took no notice of me because close at his heels were two Aussies. And as he passed me, I raised my rifle and let him have it fair in the middle of the back, almost at the same time as the other two. He went down like a pole-axed bull, and the three of us then followed on down the trench to be met by some Turks who came at us suddenly and savagely. I lunged at the nearest, but my bayonet stuck in his leather equipment, and for the moment I was helpless. Instantly, he raised his rifle to shoot me, but before he could, there was an awful bang alongside my ear, and he crumpled up at my feet. My mate behind had put his rifle over my shoulder and had shot him, but that discharge nearly blew my head off.
I'm getting a real feel of the intensity and closeness.
And closeness of it, yeah.
It's visceral, as people would say.
I wouldn't.
No, you wouldn't say that, no. You'd say it'd be rough or something like that. Now, the Australians are creeping through this network of covered trenches. They're like tunnels, Gary. Well, you know. And the battle, it sort of breaks up into hundreds of tiny, vicious skirmishes. And it's a terrifying business, isn't it?
It is, because the tunnels are very cramped. They're dark and they're dust-filled with the threat of a Turk behind every corner. Now, by about 1800, the front lines had been overrun. Despite the preliminary bombardment, the Turks had been taken by surprise, and it took them a while to react before the 1st Battalion 57th Regiment was ordered forward. And this is Major Zeki Bey of the 1st 57th Regiment.
From the regimental headquarters to the back of Mortar Ridge, you could see clearly. There was a lot of dust raised by the shells at Lone Pine. I could not see through it, but when the bombardment there ceased, we heard infantry fire. Like after thunder, you hear the rain beginning, and the observers beside us said, "The English are getting into our trenches." Our observation of this bombardment had given us the impression that the trenches subjected to it would not be in a condition to repel the attack. There had been some much damage and heavy loss. At that moment, an order arrived by telephone lines from Mustafa Kemal Pasha. "The battalion of reserves will move at once to Lone Pine." The battalion was ready to go. I gave the order to move as fast as possible to Lone Pine. On the way, we fixed bayonets. The moment we turned into that valley, we came under fire from your men at the head of it. Near there, I met the commander of one of the battalions, which had been holding the centre of the Lone Pine front. I said, "What has happened?" But he was clearly very shocked. He kept on saying, "We're lost, we're lost." I saw it was useless to ask for information from him, and I didn't want to lose time. Wow, so what does he do then?
Well, Zeki Bey launched his men forward into the counter-attack. The Turkish onslaught was presaged by a flurry of bombs. Now, the shattering detonations and slicing fragments brought sheer terror to the Australians trapped in the confined trenches.
Yeah, because sometimes, can you imagine it? There's nowhere to run. If you're in one of those narrow, tiny, cramped trenches, and this is Private Charles Duke of the 4th New South Wales Battalion.
A dark head appeared round the traverse. I immediately let fly with my rifle from my hip and missed. In reply came two cricket ball bombs. One was kicked by one of my mates round a corner, but the other was behind us. I had a moment or two of uncontrollable, paralysing fear to be utterly helpless with that thing sizzling within a few feet of me. I flattened myself in the side of the trench, clawing at it with my fingers, and certainly thought my last moment had come. By some miracle, none of us was seriously hurt.
Yeah, because remember, the bombs, what follows the bombs? What comes after the bombs? You remember this from our demonstration.
Well, the infantry.
That's right. With bayonets.
With bayonets, yeah.
Bombs and bayonets. And not surprisingly, they fall back. Now, not far away from there, we don't know where do we go. We can't pretend. It's too complex. Not far behind from there is Second Lieutenant Leckie again, Charles Leckie of the 2nd New South Wales Battalion. And he's desperately trying to hold his swiftly built barricade as the Turks sort of attacks rage up against it. And this is Charles Leckie. He liked to be called Charlie, I believe.
And he's of the 2nd New South Wales Battalion.
Fine body of men.
Then the bombing attack started. We had no bombs to retaliate with. Harkness and Cox were killed, among scores of others. Despairing appeals were made to company headquarters for bombs, but none were to be had. The men caught the enemy's bombs as they fell and hurled them back before bursting. Many were killed, hands and arms being blown off as bombs exploded in the act of being thrown back at the Turks. The trench was now packed with dead and wounded. The wounded had no hope of rescue, and when the Turks finally drove us out of this section, I'm quite sure no survivors were left.
Now, the Turks are throwing their last local reserves into the battle, and they have a grim determination. The Turks are fighting like hell. They're determined to retake every bloody, last inch from the Australians. Now, by this time, Private Duke's been forced back a bit, and he finds Lieutenant Giles, also of his battalion, who are organising the defence. And this, again, is Private Charles Duke, 4th New South Wales Battalion.
From the trench less than 30 yards away, I saw the Turks emerging and gave the warning to Lieutenant Giles, who ordered us to line the parapet to shoot at them. We did so, but almost before we could get our rifles into position, our appearance above the parapet was greeted with an appalling burst of Turkish supporting rifle fire. There was an almighty crash right in front of my face, which knocked me reeling back into the trench. I knew I was hit as blood was streaming from my forehead into my eyes and over my glasses. I was not knocked out and took my glasses off so that I could wipe them and my eyes sufficiently to look around. Imagine my horror to see every one of those lads who had lined the parapet with me lying still and dead in the bottom of the trench. Six of them all hit clean in the head, which left Lieutenant Giles and I the only survivors. It had all happened in less than 1 minute. Fortunately for us, the attacking Turks had been wiped out by rifle fire from our chaps further up the trench.
And at this time, we'll just take a brief halt.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
It was obvious that the 1st Brigade could not hold out for long under this kind of pressure, and more Australian battalions were moved forward to reinforce the line. By now, some of the trenches were all but blocked by the dead and the helpless wounded. And this is Major Dennis Lane of the 12th South and Western Australian and Tasmanian Battalion.
The elaborate overhead cover prepared by the Turks was in many places intact and gave one the impression of passing through a tortuous tunnel, the gloom being accentuated by leaving the bright sunshine. The Turkish dead had not yet been removed and so thickly carpeted the ground that there was no alternative but to tread along a line of bodies. On arrival in the firing line, the company moved along to the left of this sector where the Turks during the morning had counterattacked and effected a lodgment. The trenches here were extremely narrow and not well traversed. Our own and Turkish dead lay everywhere. And in some instances, our own wounded were still lying at the bottom of the trench. And it must have been just bloody awful. And there are pictures, very atmospheric, of after the battle, where you see pictures of them in these tunnels.
The former communications trenches were barricaded off by both sides, but the contested space between was choked with more bodies as the battle swayed to and fro. But even in the midst of all that death and destruction, there were moments of humour, as evinced by one Sergeant Campbell. And this is Sergeant Major Paul Goldenstedt of the 3rd New South Wales Battalion.
Yeah, he's talking about Sergeant Campbell, who is a great character in his unit. And this is what Paul Goldenstedt says. A sniper's bullet that removed the whole of Sergeant Campbell's front top teeth, which protruded beyond his upper lip as if they'd been taken off with a fret saw. Recovering from the shock, the bullocky in Campbell asserted itself. And there followed the best exhibition of cursing in between the gulping and spitting of mouthfuls of blood it would be possible to imagine. I don't know what the Turks thought, but the dozen or so men left in that trench roared with laughter as the eloquent Campbell beat it for the beach. I was later told that Campbell hadn't exhausted his vocabulary by the time he reached the hospital ship. Fantastic character.
Now, the situation grew more and more fraught as the Turks refused to accept the loss of their trenches at Lone Pine. For almost 4 days, the fighting raged before finally coming to a spluttering crescendo amidst mutual exhaustion on the 9th of August. And once more, this is Sergeant Major Paul Goldenstedt of the 3rd New South Wales Battalion.
The rifle, bomb and machine gun fire just before daybreak was something never to be forgotten. Our men were swept off the parapets like flies. General Smythe, VC, who commanded the 1st Brigade, issued an order for every man to step down off the parapet and prepare to meet the Turk on the floor of the trench. I was then near Lieutenant Percy Woods. Percy and I had been sergeants together. He took out a pencil and wrote a few words to his wife on a field service postcard. Having no wife and few relations that I could think of for the moment, I scribbled a few lines to her as well. And Percy fixed the bayonet to his rifle. I preferred my revolver. The feeling at that moment must be something like what a condemned man feels when the hangman is tying the rope. Anyhow, all of a sudden, there was a wild cheer. And before we knew where we were, the Turks had beat it for their trenches. So it all collapses. The Turks give up the attack.
Never had an anticlimax been more welcome. An hour or so later, they were relieved and their ordeal was over.
So give me a statistic. You know I love statistics. Do my buckery, but take me through some statistics.
Well, it's estimated that in the fighting, the Australians lost somewhere approaching 2,000 men, while the Turks, relentless counterattackers, they took their losses as high as 5,000.
Yeah, they often exaggerate Turkish casualties. We're aware of that, but it gives you an idea. The Australians had, I suppose, triumphed, but really... They've got one trench. At the end of it, they've got one trench and about 100 yards of blood-soaked ground, haven't they? And although the Turks really, 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 really objected to this and wanted that line back, has the situation changed?
No, it meant very little or indeed nothing at all. Tactically, the situation of 400 Plateau remained much the same.
Ah, so what... Ah, I've realised what the real question is. The real question, Gary, that I'm going to ask you now. Had it acted as a diversion? Had it attracted or distracted sufficient attention from the great left hook on the night of 6th, 7th of August that would punch out from Anzac? Had it, Gary? Had it?
Well, the answer is that it had indeed attracted the local reserves.
That was second.
That's good.
That's good. That's great.
But also the Turkish 9th Division resting just beyond Gaba Tepe.
Do you know where just beyond Gaba Tepe?
They were just beyond Gaba Tepe.
At? Where did we go for our holidays?
Where the hotel is.
Yeah,
the Cum Hotel.
Cum Hotel.
Hotel Cum.
Which Australians use as well when they visit Gallipoli, and certainly we do.
Now, they marched to Lone Pine, but were then called to hold Chanuk Bayir. Now, the diversion actually, therefore, attracted troops nearer to the crucial area.
Yeah, which was a bit unfortunate, but it's typical of Hamilton. Now we have got a second part to this, because we mentioned at the start there is a second attack that was launched at midnight on the 6th of August by the 6th Battalion of the Australian Battalion of the 2nd Australian Brigade. Now this attack was from Steele's post on German Officers' Trench. Now this isn't a diversion. What's this?
Well, that was designed to remove the flanking threat to the further attacks planned on the Neck and Chessboard at 04:30 the next morning.
Now, those attacks would that basically they were to be in cooperation with the big left hook from Anzac that would have had gone up Roadsden and Ridge and would be coming down behind the Neck and the Chessboard, and at the same time they'd attack out from Anzac itself. Right, so it's all complex. Now, funnily enough, we've all heard of the Neck, but we haven't heard much about German Officers' Trench. It's a classic horror story, isn't it?
Yeah, here, as at Lone Pine, tunnelling activity was central to any thought of success. And this is Major Henry Gordon Bennett.
Gordon Bennett.
Of the 6th Victoria Battalion. Three tunnels, 3 to 4 foot wide and 7 foot deep, had been dug, leading from our front line for a distance of about 30 yards. These were linked up by another tunnel, which was roughly parallel to our front line. A thin crust of earth from 6 to 12 inches thick was left as a roof to the tunnels, and from the forward tunnel a number of narrow saps were dug, leading to small posts, each capable of accommodating 3 or 4 men. These saps were just wide enough for a man to crawl through. The attack was to be launched by the 6th Battalion from these fire posts at midnight. The roofs were to be removed just after dark, and the men were to charge across the intervening 20 yards to the enemy trench. The attack was to be preceded by 3 mine explosions at 11 p.m, 11:30 p.m, and 11:40 p.m. These mines, it was hoped, would destroy a portion of the enemy trench with its garrison and completely demoralise the rest of the troops holding that section of trench.
Now, the troops that go to assault couldn't occupy these very forward tunnels until the last mine had exploded. Why, Gary?
Well, in case of reverberation, which caused the tunnels to collapse all around them. They'd be buried
alive.
Yeah.
Yeah, or buried dead. Yeah. Soon be dead anyway. So, again, you've got a lot of work to do here, Gary. I feel quite sorry. So here again is Major Henry Gordon Bennett of the 6th Victoria Battalion.
As 11 o'clock approached, everyone waited anxiously to see yards of the enemy trench go skywards. But instead, there was a low, muffled rumbling and a slight earth tremor. We peered over the parapet, expecting to see the flash of the explosion and tons of earth and a few Turks hurled into the air. But nothing happened. The mine was too deep to be effective. A minute or so later, we were all crouching low, hoping to dodge the shells the enemy poured on us in retaliation. Shell after shell landed in and around the trench, tearing great rents in the communication tunnels. At 11:30, the next mine was blown with even less effect. This brought another hurricane of shells on Steele's post. We were beginning to feel depressed. We realised that the enemy, instead of being destroyed or at least demoralised by them, had been made alert and ready. Then the third mine was blown at 11:40 with no better result.
Now, this out, we've been, both you and I, Gary, yep. have been, we've stood at Steele's post. And do you remember, were you there on the time when Bullent Yorkmus took to us to a mine
yes.
on the German officers' trench
yes.
position? So it's weird how close you can be. Not to the action, but to the scene of the action, to really get a feel of where they are.
Well, for I would say it's how close you can be to the history.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. And this whole story, it's a terrible story. Right, so the mines have got... So I presume they cancel the attack, do they?
No, orders were orders, and they would have to do their best. And they moved down the tunnels to the underground front line, ready to break through the crust of earth and charge across the 20 yards to the Turkish front line at midnight, 2400.
Now, it soon becomes apparent that the Turkish counter-bombardment had been a lot more effective than the Australian mines. And this is what Major Henry Gordon Bennett, 6th Victoria Battalion, says.
The party, moving by one tunnel, groped its way forward in the pitch-black darkness, stumbling over the heaps of debris caused by the bombardment. Movement was difficult and slow. One tunnel was completely blocked and impassable, while another was almost as bad. The party that had been detailed to use one tunnel was forced to retrace its steps along the crowded trench and to find its way to its position by an unknown route. To make matters more difficult, commands could only be given in whispers, and this made control almost impossible. Instead of reaching their position in 10 minutes, as anticipated, it took almost an hour. The time for the attack was well past, and the troops had not arrived at their posts.
Now, this sounds to me like an absolute shambles. They only get to their attacking positions at 00:35, so 35 minutes past midnight. It's only then they're ready to attack. And Major Bennett says this.
The signal for the assault was given, a blast of a whistle. Men in the fire posts jumped out and rushed forward. The moment they did, the enemy raked no man's land with machine guns, rifles and bombs. The thin line melted away. Some were hit before they left the posts. Those who followed fell back wounded, blocking the saps and preventing the rest of the attacking force from leaving the tunnel. The wounded crawled back out of the inferno into the safe refuge of the tunnel, and before many minutes it was realised that the attack had failed.
Now, you see, they're coming under fire, not just from the actual machine guns and trenches at German Officers' Trench, that's immediately in front of Steele's, but also from machine guns and rifle fire from the Turkish trenches up at Quinn's Post. That's to the left. You can picture this. I could see the intelligent look on your face as you picture the exact layout of the ground. They're also being fired at from Mortar Ridge to their front, which you might not be able to picture, and Johnson's Jolly to their right, which, again, I know you know. What's the attack? It's a total failure. This is Major Bennett again.
I telephoned Brigadier Forsyth, telling him the result of the attack. The impossibility of attacking from the congested tunnels, the failure of our mines, with the result that the enemy trench was strongly held by an alert enemy. After consulting with the divisional commander, the brigadier ordered another attempt to be made as soon as practicable.
Well, this is just insanity. I mean, communications are bad. That's one excuse for what's going on. But brigade and divisional staff, they don't know what's really happening, and the trouble is they regard they have to take German officers' trench. because otherwise the attack later on the neck at 4:30 on the 7th is going to, in the morning, is going to be an absolute disaster as well. And also the attacks on the chessboard and Quinn's Post. They're all planned for 4:30 next morning. So they've got to succeed. What happens when you have got to succeed? You've got to try again.
Now, there's also a degree of unwarranted skepticism. Skepticism.
Difficult word.
That the 6th Battalion has simply not tried hard enough. And this is Captain Carl Jess of the Headquarters 2nd Australian Brigade.
Yeah, he refers to Major Bennett as Colonel throughout, which is an honorific. He's commanding the battalion. Colonel Bennett rang up and said that as we left recesses and started to cross intervening ground, the fire increased to hellish extent and many were wounded in the recesses, which are now filled with dead and wounded who had crowded back into them, and that the assault was impossible. The brigadier rang up Colonel White and told him that the attack had failed. Colonel White, very put out, and said that they were to be put at it again and that the trench must be taken. The CO of 6th accordingly instructed to reorganise and go again. So they've got to go again. They've got to try again.
Now, Major General Walker and his Chief of Staff, Colonel Brudenell White, couldn't accept that this failure was final. Captain Jess went forward to see what was happening for himself. When he got there, he found the outlook was actually even worse than his darkest imaginings. And this is once more Captain Carl Jess of Headquarters, 2nd Australian Brigade.
The scene in the tunnel I shall never forget. Men leaning against the walls in the darkness without a word. And what their thoughts must have been, God only knows. But they must have been 100 times worse than mine. And I knew now how hopeless was the job, with no chance of surprise in it. However, it had to be tried. I found Colonel Bennett in the forward firing line, doing his best to reorganise his men, who were more or less stunned. The groans of the wounded still in the recesses and the awful blackness and silence were enough to take the heart out of anyone. Colonel Bennett himself wanted to lead the first line in the new attack, as he felt it was his duty. I would not agree. As I pointed out, it was his duty to feed with reinforcements the daring men who went out first. We eventually got the wounded and dying out, which I shall never forget, as they nearly all had 3 or 4 wounds, but seldom a groan as they were pulled out of the recesses and along the bumpy, dark tunnel floor. Wow.
Now, Bennett had gritted his teeth and set about reorganising his men for the second attempt in compliance with his orders.
He knows it's a waste of time, doesn't he? Do you not think?
Well, he knows also that it's a waste of lives, and he tried to get the assault cancelled, but he wasn't willing to disobey a direct order.
So what does he say?
Well, this is what Major Henry Gordon Bennett says. The tunnels were cleared of wounded, officers were given fresh orders for the attack, and a commencement was made to reorganise the men ready for the charge. In the dark and crowded tunnels, this took 2 hours to accomplish, but at last everything was ready. Everyone in those tunnels knew they were embarking on a forlorn hope. They knew the Turks were waiting to mow them down the moment they showed themselves. Still, they decided to give the best that was in them to make a success of the venture. The signal was given.
I can't imagine what they're feeling. All these frustrations, the delays, the feeling of hopelessness. But at last, they're ready to go. And he'd tried to go with them, but he'd been ordered to stay. Bennett watches his men go to their deaths when the new attacks finally launched at 03:53 that morning. And this is what Major Bennett says.
The enemy answered it with a hail of lead from the trench 20 yards away. Our men scrambled from the posts, only to be shot down. A few survived to find themselves alone on reaching the enemy trench. As they essayed to return, they too were hit. For the second time, the assault had failed, not because the men were unwilling to face the danger, but because it was physically impossible to succeed.
Now, this time, it's Captain Jess who rings Brigade Headquarters. He does this at 04:10, and he's trying to tell Brigadier General John Forsyth that the attempt has failed. Now, it's at this point, what happens then?
Well, he finds himself trapped in a circular nightmare as Walker and Brudenell White at Divisional Headquarters still refuse to admit or accept defeat. Now, this is odd because in the back of my mind, I've realised Brudenell White is later responsible for devising the plan for the evacuation of Gallipoli.
You mean he's a brilliant staff officer?
He's a brilliant staff officer.
Well, and Walker's a good commander as well.
And part of what he did with the evacuation plan was the preservation of life. And here he is, he's insisting on further attacks because he's refusing to accept defeat.
It's because of this pressure of this 4:30. It's the pressure of the knowing that there's got the attack in their neck and Quinn's to come. He's in a bind. You've got to respect decisions taken, but God, it's a bloody business. And this is what Captain Carl Jess says. Forsyth informed divisional headquarters, who I believe nearly went mad. Anyway, he was ordered to come round and reorganise the battalion and supervise another attack personally. When he arrived, I shall never forget his face. He knew as well as I did that the men were by this time unnerved and had been for about 36 hours without sleep, and that to attempt such an attack in daylight was slaughter. However, he was ordered to do it and we had to try. We had no idea of our losses and could only withdraw right out of the trench and reorganise. The sight on the terraces in rear of Quinn's post would have made anybody's heart bleed to see the weary, nerve-strained men moving listlessly into their places and alongside them the dressing place with scores of badly wounded men, two in particular writhing about in their death throes. Wow.
Now, yet for a while, it seemed that come what may, the 6th Battalion would again be put to the sword. And Captain Carl Jess goes on to say this.
Yeah, I want you to notice the time. It's by this time too late. Jess says this. At about 8 o'clock, Major Glassford came round from division and I put it to him that the men were not fit and it would be sheer murder to put them at it in daylight. To make matters worse, with the dawn, number 3 section attempted to attack the chessboard. That's the other attacks. And this, with our big breakout on the left, brought a hell of an artillery fire onto our already shattered trenches. At about 9 o'clock, this is way after 4:30, you'll notice, Gary. At about 9 o'clock, we received word from General Walker that no further effort would be required of the 6th Battalion that day. But we were asked if any other battalion was better fitted for the job, as if any men in the world could have done more. Forsyth replied and said that all battalions of the brigade were the same type of men. The order to take German officers' trench was given without artillery destroying it, like at Lone Pine, and without anything being done to take or occupy the attention of Johnson's Jolly. Forsyth took it much to heart. You can see they're falling out amongst themselves, the staff, aren't they?
All in all, the 6th Battalion lost 80 killed and 66 wounded. It was a dreadful episode, now largely forgotten, but surely worthy of remembrance.
Yeah, and I remember when I wrote the Gallipoli book, it struck me that this was a really dramatic incident, but it sort of swallowed away, or not swallowed, washed away by people concentrate on Lone Pine and they concentrate on the neck. And this is sort of in between. But this is part of the next story, because what would happen now at 4? We know that there's rumblings going on till 9, but what happens at 4:30?
Well, there's terrible consequences because they were interlinked assaults. The next day at 04:30 on the neck, the chessboard, Dead Man's Ridge and from Queen's Post, these attacks, they're already heavily reliant for success on the success of the New Zealand Brigade in capturing the Chanuk Bahia and then launching a simultaneous attack down through Battleship Hill onto Baby 700.
And
what's going to happen?
We're
going to find out next week, Pete.
What's the podcast called?
Disaster at Anzac. That might give it away.
Oh, should we change it? No, there's no other word for it.
Now, this is our first podcast for a while, Pete.
Back in the saddle, Gary.
Yeah.
Back in the saddle.
We'll be continuing to do live podcasts, but we are going to Gallipoli in May and October this year. There are still a few places available should anybody wish to join us. And you can, for yourself, be on the ground as close to history as you can get. And we'd love to take you along with us.
Cheers, Gary.
Cheers, Pete.
Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or visit www.blahblahblahblahblah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?